Well, knowing the history is so important. There's a communist tactic called deconstruction, where you intentionally separate people from their past, get them into a neutral where they do not remember where they came from, and then you brainwash them into the future you have planned for them. Sort of like a gene therapy for a culture. You take out the old identity and you put in the new. And so we see that they go into the classrooms and they tell the kids negative things about the founding fathers, so the kids will emotionally separate from them. Oh, they're all bad. And then you get the kids into the neutral, they're open-minded, and then you can give them your pitch for socialism or LGBT or Islam. And so this three-step process, you know, it's like a train car. You detach, you're unattached, and then you reattach. And so that they want to, whenever you see all these shows or these, you know, they tear down statues or, you know, try to malign every single founding father, say, well, they're all bad. You know, it really doesn't matter if they're bad or not. They gave us a present, and that present is we get to be in charge of our lives. We don't have a king.
Doesn't matter. That's what I say about Thomas Jefferson. I don't care if he ran naked every full moon down Main Street. I don't care. What do I care? He wrote the Declaration of Independence. My gosh. Yes or no, is that the greatest political document we've seen in thousands of years?
Right, yeah, because it says rights come from a creator.
Getting back to William, we kind of digressed a little bit, but really it's just, I mean, this is really all the same thing. Looking back, you started this discussion, what, in the 1500s? And now we're 400 or 500 years past that. And you can see the fingerprints of some mission or some overarching agenda and progression of mankind. And you can also see the returning back. It's like a dog to his vomit, as the Bible says. You can also see that going on. And if we don't understand these events, if we don't understand the pilgrims and Thanksgiving and what that means, I mean, some people have said that Thanksgiving is really the only Christian holiday, truly Christian holiday in America. I don't know what you think, but let's get back to around Squanto and Thanksgiving and go from there.
Right. So another interesting thing is the pilgrims attempted communism. So background. It was a company colony, and the company bylaws said everybody had to own everything in common. During the Middle Ages, there were no companies. It was a sin to pay or receive interest. It was called usury. And so there were no companies. There were guilds where you would have like this in club of shoe cobblers with 1,000 rules if you wanted to open up a shoe cobbler shop. There were some religious orders that would do some kind of endeavors, but there were no things that we would identify today as companies. And so if you wanted to do something big, like sail around the world looking for spices or gold, you had to hit up some rich guy or a king to underwrite the whole thing. So, you know, Columbus had to hit up the king and queen of Spain. Walter Raleigh was a rich guy in England. He financed personally a Virginia colony. He named Virginia, Virginia, after the Virgin Queen Elizabeth. The name of his little settlement was called Roanoke, and it's 1584. But then the Spanish decided to attack England with their armada in 1588. And so basically his little Roanoke colony was abandoned for several years. When they finally send a boat back over there, it's gone. It's a ghost settlement. And so he lost 30,000 pounds sterling personally on that attempt. And so nobody else, a rich person, wanted to attempt any new colonies. So the first, what we would call company, was after the Reformation. And it was in England. And it was in the 1550s. And you had a bunch of adventurers is what they called themselves, but that was the word for investor. But it was the Company of Merchant Adventurers, and they were going to go over to China by going north of Russia. And they have three boats. They all freeze in the ice. Two of the boats, every single person on board is frozen stiff. The third boat, a dog sled, came out from Russia and rescued them, and they took them to meet the Tsar. And so they changed the name of the company to the Muscovy Company, Tsar Ivan the Terrible. It really didn't make much money. But the big company was the Dutch East India Company. And this was around 1600. And anybody, not just a bunch of rich guys, anybody baker, blacksmith, cook could invest money in a ship going to Indonesia looking for nutmeg or spices, cinnamon. And when the ship came back to Holland, you would get paid a profit. If you wanted to sell your interest in the boat while it was at sea, you would go down to something called the Amsterdam Stock Exchange, the first ever stock exchange. And if the boat sank or was captured by Muslim pirates or something, that's when the Dutch invented insurance companies. Insurance companies came from the Dutch. The Dutch settled a colony in America called New Amsterdam, which eventually became New York. But they had a New Amsterdam Stock Exchange along the wall of the little settlement. And when the British took it over, that turned into Wall Street. And but again, this idea was common people could invest in these big endeavors, and then they would get a share of the profits that come in. And anyway, so after starting the British East India Company, the British started another company called the Virginia Company. And a bunch of guys invested money. They tried to settle Jamestown, Virginia. They had malaria, disease, famine, Indian attacks. One winter, they had 500 people. By the end of the winter, they had 50. I mean, wow. They're just dying right and left. It turns so bad that finally the king has to take it over and make it a royal crown colony where the king is ruling this thing directly. This happened later in India, right? So for 100 years, the British East India Company controlled the entire nation of India. Finally, the people of India appealed to Queen Victoria and said, look, can we just deal with you directly instead of going through this company? You know, but so in Jamestown, they sent over a royal crown governor. There was a third type of company called a proprietary colony. So third type of colony. So you have company colonies, royal crown colonies, and proprietary colony. A proprietary colony is where the king gives the whole colony to a friend as his personal property. So William Penn got all of Pennsylvania as his personal property. He decided to do something good with it, a holy experiment to let all the persecuted peoples of Europe come and live together. Baltimore, Maryland, was originally personal property of Lord Baltimore of Maryland. And then the Carolinas were originally personal property of seven Lord proprietors. But back to Virginia Company, went belly up. Now it's a Royal Crown Colony. But the Pilgrims land. Now, the Pilgrims had a Plymouth Company, and they had bylaws. And the bylaws were written by some, you know, pencil pusher at some desk. And the bylaw says everything is owned in common for 7 years. Everything that was gained by trading with the Indians, fishing, you know, scavenging, everything would go into ye common pot and ye common store. And everyone would get their livelihood, their food, their clothes, and everything out of ye common stock. And then at the end of 7 years, what was left in ye common stock would be divided up equally amongst the planters and the adventurers, the investors over in England. Well, it worked for, they tried making it work for a couple of years, but the Pilgrims were starving. And nobody, William Bradford says, this communistic plan did not work, because the older men thought it an indignity to be grouped together with these younger men and having to do the same kind of work that they do. The younger men considered it an injustice that they could do three times as much work as this old guy or, you know, a feeble guy, but they wouldn't get any more of the what came in. They said that the wives complained because they didn't want to wash some other men's clothes. And some husbands would not brook it, would not allow their wife to wash somebody else's underwear, right? And and he said that because they were facing another winter and they didn't want to starve, William Bradford said nobody wanted to go out and plant. My baby's sick. I can't plant today, you know. And so he said we had to come up with a fitter plan. And so he said it's not – due to the people, because these were good and godly people. They tried for several years to do, but he says it's this communistic plan itself. It just doesn't work. And so after much discussion, he says they gave every family a plot of land. And he says this made all hands more industrious, and everyone went out to work, and even the mothers would take their little kids with them, and they would go out and plant. Why? Because they got everything that came in. And he says this was done so that we wouldn't be, have to suffer want through another winter and die. And so here the pilgrims experimented with communism. And it didn't work. Nobody was motivated to do anything more, and it caused a hatred amongst them, because it destroyed, you know, respect for the older people and the ones that were more creative and so forth. But he says once they gave everybody their own property, they had an abundance of stuff, and that sort of led to these these generous Thanksgiving feasts that we see. I sort of went past it pretty quick, but Squanto was their interpreter, and so he put them on good terms with the other Indian tribes. This was something that Jamestown did not experience. And so the first Thanksgiving, the Indians showed up with their deer, their turkey. The pilgrims had their, you know, squash and their cranberry sauce. And so they ate all day and did foot races and all kinds of things. And then at the end of the day, the Indians rolled up in their blankets on the ground and went to sleep. And the next day, they woke up, and there they are. They have Thanksgiving for a second day. And at the end of the day, they roll up in their blankets and go to sleep, and they wake up, and there they are. And so they have Thanksgiving a third day. So the first Thanksgiving went on for 3 days. And then an interesting thing, that the chief of the Indians, Powhatan, he fell ill. And so one of the pilgrim leaders, Edward Winslow, goes to doctor up the chief, and he recovers. And you think, well, that's really nice. Well, it was a little bit more than that, because in Indian culture, if you doctor a chief and the chief dies, you die.
He didn't know, did he know what responsibility he was taking on there?
Well, either before or after, but William Bradford did write about it, so he must have known. So it was a serious thing to say, hey, you know, can I take a look at your chief? It's like, he better get better now. But that ended up with this first entire generation of peace between the pilgrims and the Native Americans. And then you had, wow. There's two threads that trace through history, greed and the gospel. You always have people motivated by the gospel, and they're the ones that have orphanages and medical clinics, dig wells and villages, you know, collect shoes and give them to poor people. And you always have, you know, the Salvation Army. Here's the biggest organization worldwide that feeds the poor, takes care of the sick. And they do this for everybody. They don't care if you're LGBT or not. The Salvation Army will take care of your needs. And that's why everyone's all upset at Chick-fil-A for pulling money from the Salvation Army, because they minister to everybody. So
that's a big mistake. That so people understand. I don't know if our audience knows that Chick-fil-A for years has been very pro Salvation Army. They've been pro family, and the LGBT community has been extremely critical of Chick-fil-A, and all it's done for Chick-fil-A is make them more popular and more money. And now as they go to Europe, they're starting to bend to get into different European markets. So I just want to give a little background so people – I think that's a huge mistake that they're making. I don't know your thoughts.
No, it is. And the thing is, you can never appease the other side.
They won't quit.
It's a lust-driven agenda. And lust, by definition – the more you yield to it, the more it wants. So they did a bait and switch on us. So originally they said, look, we just want to have gay marriage. If two people love each other, and who cares what we do in our bedrooms? And then the Christian type people are saying, okay, you can do that. No sooner does it pass than they make a beeline to the preschool and begin indoctrinating little kids and begin teaching them transgendered stuff and drag queen story hour. And it's like, whoa, if you would have told us that you were going to push this, we would have never voted for it. And now they've taken it under the previous president, where they've sent the Department of Justice in saying, if you don't embrace this agenda, we're going to prosecute you. They go to all the leaders in the military and says, look, if you don't embrace this brand new morality, we're kicking you out. And so it went from, look, I'm being nice and tolerant by letting you get married and letting you do what you want in your bedroom, and now you're in the driver's seat and you're being intolerant of me. They're not content with coming out of the closet. They want to shove you into it. And worse, they want to take your kids and have you be happy that they're taking their kids.
This is all connected to this whole discussion in the historical perspective to me. You mentioned communism and socialism, about private property. This incident certainly, most certainly influenced the founding fathers, this idea of life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness, that property only has value when one of the people hold it and create value on an individual level, and that the action of self-interest. So by acting in your own self-interest, you actually raise the level and the value of property and the value of everything. That was a revolutionary concept.
Yeah, and that's where you get copyrights and patents for trademarks. This was a big deal to the founding fathers. So you could spend all night long in your barn creating a cotton gin, or working on the telegraph. Robert Fulton inventing a steamboat. You would spend that time because you would benefit from it, and then you would create an industry. You'd be meeting a need. I mean, if you weren't meeting a need, nobody would buy it. It wouldn't be any help. But it unleashed human creativity. In communist countries, or wherever there's a king or a dictator, you create something that's good, boom, they just take it.
Why would you create anything?
I was reading about one of these Japanese guys that invented Nintendo or one of those games. And, he was real popular, but then they were switching to the video games. You know, he came out with the first goggles you put on, and you can see in the 3D, sort of virtual reality. But they cut his funding, so he only did it in black and white. And at the show, people were doing it. This isn't any good. It's black and white. And he was so ashamed by it, he committed suicide. When you're in a culture where you don't have ownership of it, they just take it away from you, and they have no feelings of having to be in gratitude. In Europe, you have kings that would bring a scientist on his staff to create something, and the scientist got a stipend, got some money from the king. So he was sort of motivated to be creative. If he was creative enough, he more or less, got a job for life. But nevertheless, in America, you got to own the invention. You got to own the copyright to the book or the dictionary or whatever it was. And so it unleashed this creativity that I can spend all this time, creating a modem or a fax machine or something, spurring this technology. And anyway, I sort of got away from my thought I was going toward. So there's always two threads you trace through history, greed and the gospel. You always have people motivated by the gospel, and they're the ones that have orphanages, medical clinics, and give to the poor. You always have people motivated by greed, and they're the ones that take land from Indians, sell people into slavery, and vote for candidates they think will help their pocketbook, even though that candidate stands for, immoral things. And so the two threads cut through the human heart. But you look back at history and say, well, this race is good and this race is bad. No. You got good people and bad people in that race, and good people and bad people in that race. It's a software problem, not a hardware problem. It's the thinking in the brain, not the color of the skin. And I tell people, we're spirit, mind, and body. And so your mind is like a super fancy computer. It's more than that, but it's at least that. And your body's like the computer case, which makes it silly for people to argue over what color computer cases are. Silvers are better than greens, better than, yellows. Like, doesn't matter what color the computer case is. What matters is what software is running on the thing. What apps are on your phone, right? Not what color your phone is. And so it doesn't matter what color somebody's skin is. It's what thinking is going on. Is it gospel thinking? Love your enemies. Do good to them that hate you. Give. Be charitable. Or is it a selfish software program? Being a bully, and subduing people and cutting off their heads and so forth. And so anyway, so you look back at history, you can see these two threads. You can see people that really are genuine, wanting to help the Native Americans, and then you see these traders that will sell them alcohol in exchange for stuff, knowing that they have a higher metabolism and it's going to immediately go into their system and go to their head, you know, and they'll get this immediate, you know, inebriation, but it'll be detrimental to the Native Americans as a whole. But it's like, I don't care. I'll give them the fire water just because I want to, you know. So you always have these two threads, greed and the gospel, good people wanting to help and then, you know, greedy people wanting to take advantage of it. And
We have just a few minutes left, 3 or 4 minutes. It's been fantastic to talk with you. Your ability to go from different subjects and put a historical spin on it is really profound. And your website, American Minute, I highly, highly recommend it. Just quick hitting, provocative thoughts about different historical topics or what happened on this day. I mean, you're guaranteed to learn something. You're guaranteed to connect with something inside you, something part of our past, which is vitally important. I have been personally, the show has taken on the mantle or the direction that we need to emotionally connect to our inheritance and really the foundation of this country because we prefer our ancestors. It's because they latched onto some eternal truth and some eternal platform that is the greatest form of government we have seen in at least millennium, and that will lead to our happiness, our benefit, our safety, our peace. That's what I believe. But now we're letting that go. So in the last 3 or 4 minutes, obviously you're concerned about politics and where we are and what have you. Just leave us with the last, what are the most important things on your mind or historical story or whatever? What do we need to know from William Federer as we go into the end of this year?
Oh, well, thank you. Well, my website, again, is AmericanMinute.com. The book I've primarily talked about today is The Treacherous World of the 16th Century and How the Pilgrims Escaped It. I did, by the way, do a book on the history of Santa Claus and all the Christmas traditions, if you want to do something in December. Giving it a broad picture, every generation in history has had crises. Attila the Hun, Genghis Khan, bubonic plagues, you know, World War II. I mean, every generation. And if you... you read history, people respond three ways. One is they're part of the problem. Two is they ignore the problem. And three, they're part of the answer. And it's sort of like that God knows what era we're living in. He knows the crises, and he's sort of watching to see how we respond. You know, God knew what was in Abraham's heart, but he wanted to see him take his son to the top of Mount Moriah and be willing to kill him. There's something about God knows your heart, but he wants to see you do something. He wants, right? So we have an opportunity. So the crises in every generation is sort of the catalyst. You know, in freshman chemistry, you would have this little beaker and, you know, would have a solution, but you'd put in another chemical and it would be a catalyst and it would cause a chemical reaction, and you would have some things precipitating and getting heavy and falling to the bottom of the beaker, and other things would turn into little bubbles and float to the top. But it didn't happen, and you didn't see it until this catalyst was put in there. It's like the crisis of each generation allows us to show the Lord and the world what we're made of. And I heard somebody say there's three groups of people: those that make things happen, those that watch things happen, those that wonder what happened. And we want to be those that make things happen for good.
Oh, fantastic. There's the music. Dr. Federer, William Federer, it's fantastic. AmericanMinute.com is...
Hi, this is Jay at the Pyram Mall. I thought I would discuss an item that's very valuable to my personal health and well-being. That product is called Curcumin X4000. Its potent antioxidant properties have been shown to decrease swelling and allow us to enjoy our golden years. Take control over your health today, guys. Order Curcumin by calling 877-817-9829 or order at thepowermall.com. That's thepowermall.com.
We've all heard about antibiotics, but what about probiotics? Antibiotic means against life. Probiotic means pro-life. Antibiotics kill bacteria that are infectious and harmful to the body. They also kill the good bacteria, though, that are necessary for good health. Probiotics from Living Streams replaces the healthy balance of friendly bacteria and normalizes the digestive tract. Gastritis, ulcers, diarrheal disease is just a few of the problems people develop when the intestinal flora is out of balance. Living Streams probiotics create the healthy balance needed for good digestion, suppresses growth of pathogenic bacteria, and actually increases resistance to infection. Call the Power Hour, 877-817-9829. Order your Living Stream probiotics today. They're available in 2, 4, and 8-ounce bottles, and Living Stream's probiotics comes with a money-back guarantee. Get your body back in balance with Living Stream's probiotics today. 877-817-9829. That's 877-817-9829. Living Stream's probiotics. Everyone should be pro-life.
Hi, this is Catherine at the Power Hour. The Power Mall began when Joyce Riley discovered an all-natural soap that heals skin issues and can replace your bathing, laundry, and household cleaning products. That soap is Miracle 2 and is made from natural minerals and coconut extract with no added fragrances or colors and is naturally concentrated and biodegradable. I guarantee after you discover how amazing Miracle 2 products are, you'll recommend them to everyone you know. To order, call 877-817-9829 or visit thepowermall.com today. You'll learn why so many people say, it's not just soap, it's a miracle.
With dozens of food storage companies buying up airtime all over radio, it's hard for you to know which company you can actually trust. Humana Food Storage is nutritious, is GMO-free, contains no aspartame, no high fructose corn syrup, has no chemicals, preservatives, or soy. And Humana Food Storage has a 25-year shelf life. Call Jay at 877-817-9829. That's 877-817-9829. Or order online at thepowermall.com.
America made just for you. Food stores I love to eat. Yum!
You taught me about fermentation, and thus you have taught our audience, because I talk about my sauerkraut, which is in the cabinet, waiting for me to eat right now. And I cannot thank you enough for giving me the guts and taking away the fear to go make my own sauerkraut that I would not die and that I would be able to eat it in a healthy fashion. Thank you so much.
It's my pleasure. I'm so glad to hear you're making sauerkraut.
Oh, my goodness. It is so good. And I know that was, you know, what sparked your interest in fermentation also. Now, before we get to how to ferment or those issues, what is it about fermentation that is so important? Why would you write a whole entire book on this, and why does our body need this?
Okay, so what fermentation is the transformative action of microorganisms. You know, all of the raw products of agriculture, all of the things that constitute our food, are covered with microorganisms. In the hunter-gatherer context, when people are spending each day gathering the food resources to get them through that day, the dynamics of how these organisms transform food are not so relevant or important. But, you know, as soon as we started shifting into agricultural societies and investing lots of our energy into crops that are ready at a certain moment of the year and needing for those crops to feed us through the rest of the year, then fermentation and the dynamics of how food ages after it is harvested becomes critically important. And so, you know, fermentation is the primary means by which people in temperate regions have effectively preserved food resources, from the seasons of relative scarcity to get them through the seasons of relative, from the seasons of relative abundance to get them through the seasons of relative scarcity. So there's inevitability to fermentation because microorganisms are on all of the food that we eat, and, you know, some microorganisms can just decompose food and make it rotten or spoiled or so that it is no longer appropriate to put into our mouths. So, you know, it's just been critically important, all around the world for people to, observe how by manipulating environmental conditions, rather than food spoiling or becoming rotten, food could actually be made more delicious, more stable for storage or transportation, and or more digestible. To get into some of the health benefits, basically by eating the subset of fermented foods that are not cooked after their fermentation that still have live bacteria intact in them, it's a strategy for replenishing and diversifying gut bacteria, you know, that are literally under attack by chemicals that we have daily exposure to, you know, meaning antibiotic drugs, antibacterial cleansing products, chlorine in water. So, really, we have exposure to all of these things every day. I mean, whether or not we're taking antibiotics, you know, there's a runoff of the, you know, extraordinary antibiotic use that accumulates in our water table. So our drinking water has rising levels of antibiotics in them. The meat and the milk produced by, you know, factory farming, conventional agriculture has residues of antibiotics. And, you know, we just have this daily exposure, and we need to be consciously replenishing and diversifying these bacterial populations that are so critical to our functionality, you know, not only in terms mm-hmm. of digesting food and assimilating nutrients, but also in terms of regulating our immune responses. The bacteria in our gut are centrally important to our ability to have a functional immune system.
Okay, now I need to have these things made really simple for me, and I know that you are just such an expert on so much of this that it may be hard for you to do this in my simple nature, but when I go when I go get this big jar of cabbage and salt that I've put together and I've set in the cabinet, and after 10 days when I go get this and I take that first bite of that sauerkraut or that cabbage and salt and water combination, what is happening inside my gut? What does that do to my body?
So basically, you know, in your jar, the cabbage is fermenting. You don't need to add any bacteria to that because all raw plant material is covered with bacteria that always includes lactic acid bacteria. When you get the vegetables submerged under their own juices in a slightly salty environment, that really encourages the lactic acid bacteria, and they easily become dominant. You know, you have an environment that is very dense in lactic acid bacteria, you know, that is producing as its byproduct lactic acid. That's the sourness of sauerkraut, is the lactic acid. And 10 days is kind of arbitrary. You know, you could eat it after a couple of days and have a smaller accumulation of lactic acid. You could leave it potentially for months if you have a cool spot, and let it get even more sour, more accumulation of lactic acid. That's really just, you know, personal preference, how long you like to ferment it for. But the important concept is to understand that, you know, the cabbage and the brine that it's in are rich and dense in these living lactic acid bacteria. And, you know, human organisms have a very, very intimate relationship with lactic acid bacteria.
We need
one of the, you know, really important groups of bacteria that exist in our digestive systems and enable us to function. And so, you know, eating these foods rich in lactic acid bacteria, you know, can effectively replenish and diversify important bacterial populations in our intestines.
And our bodies need living items, and we don't get enough of them. So eating like sprouts or eating fermented vegetables, I put in zucchini in mine because all of it came from my garden, so I knew that it was had not any pesticides on it, which was important. But I put a lot of other things with this.
Yeah, it's a very versatile process, and, you know, the most famous example of it is sauerkraut, which is fermented cabbage. But, you know, you can be very creative. You could use, you know, string beans, green tomatoes, any kind of peppers, eggplants, radishes, turnips, carrots,
wow,
parsnips, Brussels sprouts. It's just an extremely versatile process. You could do it with any vegetable, which doesn't mean that every vegetable will be equally delicious. I mean, I encourage people to experiment, but experiment in small batches. You can mix different vegetables together in a batch. You can spice it differently. You know, German tradition, people love to use juniper berries. If you go a little further east in Europe, caraway seeds are very common. In Russia, cranberries and apples are often used to flavor the sauerkraut. In Korea, of course, the kimchi has chili peppers and ginger and garlic and shallots. or onions. But you also can season them in non-conventional ways. I've had some beautiful curry krauts made with with turmeric and cumin, and you could add any kind of seasoning you like. Really, it's an extremely versatile process.
Now, if you add something such as onion or garlic, am I not to be afraid that I might kill the good bacteria because it's antibacterial? The garlic.
No, you don't need to be concerned about killing it. I mean, you actually can just pickle garlic or onions alone. I mean, in fact, all bacteria are could be called antibacterial because they all produce what are called inhibitory substances that help protect them from other bacteria in the environment. But you don't have to worry about stopping the fermentation. If you add a lot of salt, you will slow down the fermentation, and in many contexts, that would be seen as a desirable outcome.
Really pleased to have him join us today. We're talking about the process of fermentation, how easy it really is to do, but there's been so much misinformation about fermentation that a lot of people are afraid of fermentation. Take that fear away from us, Sandor, please.
Well, I mean, I think that a few things have happened. First, let me say that certain ferments, like the vegetable ferments, there are no safer foods. The USDA reports that there has never been a single case of food poisoning documented in the United States from fermented vegetables. There
Wow.
are not many foods you could say that about. So this really is a process that's intrinsically safe. And we hear about people getting sick from eating raw vegetables. But even if the vegetables we were to make sauerkraut out of had been subjected to some sort of incidental contamination, really this is a strategy for safety as much as anything else, because, none of the organisms that we would think of as food poisoning organisms can exist in an acidic environment. So this really is a strategy for safety. Now, the reason that I believe people have come to, have fearful associations, is that the earliest triumphs of microbiology involved identifying pathogenic bacteria. So, really all of us alive in this historical moment, at least, who grew up in the United States and many other places in the West, have grown up with this idea that bacteria are bad. And the only good bacteria is a dead bacteria. And so, we're used to, attempting to kill bacteria however we can. And I think that, nothing illustrates this more vividly than antibacterial hand cleansing products, right? I mean, if we know that soap is important, to rinse the outer layer and the bacteria that are on our hands after we do various unsavory things off, then obviously a chemical cleanser that will kill bacteria must be better. And so everyone's washing their hands with these antibacterial chemicals, but nobody really believes fewer people are getting sick from that. And as a matter of fact, the American Medical Association is opposed to the widespread use of these cleansing products because they are hastening this problem of bacteria developing resistance to the chemical compounds. But anyway, we just have this generalized fear of bacteria. And, I think that our basic hygiene practices are certainly important. But, we can't afford to continue to think of bacteria as our enemies. Bacteria are our ancestors, and we cannot function without bacteria. So we have to, we have to embrace bacteria to a certain degree. And I think that's one thing these foods can do is help us to embrace bacteria and really invite beneficial bacteria, back into our bodies, which is very important. The other thing is that I think because of canning, which was invented in the 1900s, and the potential for botulism developing in canning, that people have developed a generalized fear of food preservation, and they don't even really know what that's about. And so the idea of fermenting something at room temperature using bacteria seems very, very scary for people. But really, at least in the realm of fermenting raw vegetable material, it is just intrinsically safe. There is no record of danger. No hidden pathogens lurking in there that we need to be concerned about.
Okay, and I encourage the people to listen to what he is saying and try it. We're talking this hour to Sandor Katz, and we're talking about the art of fermentation. And if you have never done it before and it sounds like it is frightening, well, don't be afraid. They've done it for thousands of years, and that's how they preserved their food, and they ate very well. Now, Sandor, are there certain things we need to do today because of the change in our quality of food? Do we need to use organic food as much as possible?
Well, I mean, I think that there are many, many compelling reasons to, support agriculture that does not, use pesticides and other potentially harmful chemicals. But, I mean, I will say that I have had experience fermenting all sorts of vegetables that people have handed me, including, you know, the products of chemical agriculture. Certainly the process of fermentation works no matter what the source of the vegetables. And there's even a little bit of research suggesting that residue from organophosphate compounds will be reduced by fermentation. But I think that there are, there are many compelling reasons to always support organic agriculture no matter what it is that you are.
Believe me. I agree 1,000%. And to pay 10 cents extra for organic carrots versus regular carrots, it's not going to break anybody, and it is well worth it.
But any kind of vegetables, and really, I mean, I could take 30 seconds and just describe how simple it is to make your own fermented vegetables. You
okay,
can use as a vessel a jar that you already have. A quart-sized jar will take about 2 pounds of vegetables. You just chop up those vegetables. Doesn't matter whether you chop them coarsely or finely. That's just personal preference. Lightly salt them. You don't need to weigh or measure the salt. Just salt them lightly, then mix it up, squeeze it a little bit, and taste it. The squeezing is kind of important because it bruises the vegetables, breaks down cell walls, and they start giving up their juices. You want to squeeze them hard for a few minutes until they're nice and juicy with the salt on them, and then just taste it, make sure there's adequate salt, add a little bit more salt if necessary, mix it up, and then stuff it in the jars with some force so that as you press down near the top of the jar, liquid rises up and covers the vegetables. And then you could leave it for, 2 days, 2 weeks, 2 months, depending on the flavors that you like and the temperature of your living space.
Okay, questions we've already had. Do you have the water come up to the very top and so it hits the lid or not?
No, I generally leave a small gap because there's always going to be expansion, especially in the first couple of days when you'll have a lot of carbon dioxide produced. And so if you fill it to the very top, it'll just spill out. So I always leave a small area, but not too big of an area at the top.
Okay. Do you
maybe an inch.
Oh, an inch. Okay. Up to then like the shoulder of the jars then.
Yeah.
All right.
Or up
then
to where the threads begin. Let's say a half an inch.
Okay. Do you then put the screwed lid on very tight or not?
It depends. it's going to produce carbon dioxide, so if you put the lid on tight, then you're going to need to sort of burp it and release that. So what I like to do is just put it on tight, leave it right on my kitchen counter, and in the morning while I'm making my tea, release the pressure. You could also leave it on loosely, or you could leave off the top altogether and just drape a little cloth over the top. You have lots of options.
Oh, interesting. Then, now I always put mine in a container and then put it in the cabinet. Should I leave it on the shelf in the light or put it in a dark
cabinet?
Well,
it doesn't need to be in the light, but in terms of, being able to loosen the lid, it's helpful to have it be out so you can see it and remember it. I certainly wouldn't seal it and then put it in the pantry, or you might forget about it and find a big mess in there. The pressure can be significant, and depending on the kind of jar and lid you use, it could certainly explode a jar.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, I did not know that. Now, I put mine down in the cabinet just away from what I'm doing. But I also want to remind people, be sure and put a little note out or something, because you may forget about it and find it, too much too late.
And, sometimes people get a little caught up in, like, different ways they have heard about people doing it or seen people doing it. And let me just assure you and your listeners that, a process like this that has become so widespread, I mean, literally billions of people practice this across a vast geographic area, and there's lots of different ways people do it. Lots of different types of vessels people use. You can do it in an open vessel where there is free air circulation at the top. You can do it in a closed vessel. Because it produces some carbon dioxide, you need to have a way to release that. People have engineered all sorts of clever solutions, but I try to encourage people to just look around their homes and see what they already have that they could use as a fermentation vessel. But certainly lots of, you know, beautiful and elegantly engineered, you know, specialized crocks and jars have been designed specifically for this purpose. But you don't need any specific gadgetry. You can just do it in a, you know, in a regular jar that you already have. Maybe there's a crock, you know, from your great-grandparents, you know, sort of sitting around in a garage or a barn somewhere. You know, crocks are really wonderful vessels. Lots of options.
Now, I use a mason jar or curd jar. You can go to the thrift store and buy a bunch of jars and boil them and clean them out and then buy your new lids. And that's what I
absolutely.
Do. Yeah, and that's what I use. But I will also say that I cannot tell you the number of times that I've had like 2-week-old sprouts I found in the cupboard that I forgot to take care of.
It's a danger with, you know, putting away things that are still in process.
That's right. Now, you also cover in here, besides vegetables, you do meat, you cover milk, of all things. I would have never thought of that. Fermenting milk. Now,
well, you know, yogurt. Yogurt is the most obvious example, but really all, you know, all but the most mild cheeses are products of fermentation. You know, when you have a choice between mild cheddar cheese and sharp cheddar cheese, it has to do with how long a period it has fermented, because the acids accumulate over time and the flavor becomes more sharp as time passes.
I am so thrilled because in here you also do fermenting grains, which includes, of course, sprouting and rejuvenilac, which a lot of people want to know how to do. But growing mold cultures such as tempeh, amikaze, and then in fermenting beans seeds, beans, seeds, and nuts. But then you also cover fermenting beers and other grain beverage, grain-based alcoholic beverages. Would you say that making your own beer and wine is better for you than store-bought? Is there any difference?
Well, sure. I mean, you may have noticed that alcoholic beverages never are labeled with their ingredients.
How do they get away with all sorts of
unsavory, you know, preservative chemicals and other types of ingredients that end up in alcoholic beverages. And I think, you know, you're always more empowered when you make something yourself and know exactly what's in it. But, I mean, I would say that there are ways that you can make beer and wine using what I would describe as wild fermentation practices, where you're basing them upon communities of organisms that are already present on the foods that you're fermenting. And so you can certainly make beers and wines that are probiotic, that in addition to yeast, have lactic acid bacteria in them. And I would say, you know, most traditional alcoholic beverages have been much lighter on the alcohol and also probiotic, because they have these other kinds of organisms present in them.
We've been talking a lot about kombucha. Would you enlighten us on kombucha and explain to people what that really is?
Kombucha is fermented sweet tea. So you basically make tea, sweeten it with sugar, cool it down to body temperature, and then the starter you use is a SCOBY, S-C-O-B-Y, which stands for Symbiotic Community of Bacteria and Yeast. And in the case of kombucha, its physical manifestation is a rubbery flat pad. It looks something like a pancake that floats on top of the tea, and that provides the organisms that ferment it. From other people who are kombucha enthusiasts, they're usually eager to give away layers of their mother because they get fatter with
every
batch of tea they sit on.
Explain the mother, Cassandra. Explain the mother.
I'm sorry. The mother is the SCOBY. The SCOBY is commonly referred to as the mother of kombucha. And so, you know, you can obtain one either from a kombucha enthusiast who's trying to give them away, you know, or there's lots of commercial operations that sell kombucha mothers. Really the best kombuchas to me are done as a two-stage fermentation, where first you have your sweet tea fermenting with the mother. After that fermentation, reaches its conclusion. Then if you pour it off of the mother and then mix that fermented sweet tea with some fruit juice or vegetable juice or something like that makes the most, interesting and compelling flavors.
I love buying kombucha drink in the stores, especially the new one that's got the chia seed in it, but it's very expensive. It's $4 a bottle. So, you know, for people that might spend their money on a Starbucks, I spend it on kombucha. But is there a way to make your own drink, and is it beneficial, or is it a lot of hype?
Well, certainly you can make your own kombucha. I mean, it's very easy, and I would say each serving of kombucha really only costs a few cents to make. So absolutely, anyone who loves to drink kombucha, I would say get yourself a kombucha mother and start playing around with it, and it's fun, it's delicious. You'll save money. I mean, I would say that there's something beneficial to it, and that there's a lot of hype. We can't expect specific foods to be panaceas. You know, we can't expect that, you know, drinking kombucha is just gonna, solve all of our health challenges. I think that there has been quite a bit of unsubstantiated hype for kombucha. But that said, let me say that, you know, kombucha, sauerkraut, yogurt, a diet that includes a variety of different types of live culture foods has the potential to transform anybody's health. And it doesn't matter if you have just been diagnosed with some, terrible, acute health crisis, or you've been living with a chronic condition for years and years, or you're the healthiest specimen you've ever met, or you're experiencing the effects of aging. You know, whatever your health status, just the ability to digest food better, assimilate nutrients better, have a better functioning immune system, these are tremendous benefits that can help anybody, and we don't need to make outrageous claims that they will cure a specific disease.
I like that you say that, because it's everything in combination that you eat. Welcome back to Power Hour. Thank you for joining us, caring about your world. We've only got about 3 minutes left with Sandra Katz. Let me quickly tell you that pets, children. Can they both benefit, Sandor, from having fermented foods?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, you know, some people tell me that, like, you know, they believe that children intrinsically don't like, pickles and other fermented foods, and that is completely contrary to my experience. And I hear lots of stories of people whose kids learn to love these foods as very young children, and also of people whose animals enjoy them. I can tell you that my dog enjoys lightly fermented sauerkraut, but if it's too acidic, she doesn't like it anymore.
And, you know, and it seems like when you can control the amount of sourness with the amount of time that you do this, but you don't need that much, really, because if you can take a couple of tablespoons and put it over your salad or whatever, it mixes very well with the salad. I always put sauerkraut with my salad. And also,
this is a food that people do not typically eat huge amounts of, and it's a condiment just to spice things up.
Oh, I can do that, though. I can do it with sauerkraut. And the canned. Do not think that canned is going to be as good as fresh, because all the stuff is killed in it because it's been pasteurized. So don't depend on canned. Now, question on the Internet from Jean in Maine. How long will properly fermented foods last?
It depends. It depends on the environment you have to store them. If you have an unheated root cellar, they certainly will last through the winter in that root cellar. If you're talking about in your refrigerator, salty, acidic food in a mostly full jar will last for years and years in the refrigerator.
Whoa.
If we're talking about room temperature in a heated living space, probably what will happen is after 2 to 3 months, these enzymes will start to digest the pectin and make the vegetables really mushy and, to me, not very appealing anymore. And so the warmer the environment, the sooner those will kick in.
Okay.
And change the quality of the crust.